Welcome, everyone. Can you hear me okay, by the way, in the back? It's a pleasure to have you here for tonight's Civic Forum. My name is David Scobie. I'm the director of the Harward Center for Community Partnerships here at Bates. The Harward Center is an academic center at Bates whose mission is to integrate community and civic engagement into the Bates education through service learning and community-based research and the support for student volunteerism in the community, and also for convenings and conversations like this, where we bring people together to discuss important issues about community life, public life, policy, and politics. The Civic Forum, in particular, is a series of presentations and panels that we do every year aimed at thinking together and talking together about important issues of citizenship, policy, and politics, important for the Bates community, for our larger Maine community, and beyond. This year, we're having two different series under the Civic Forum rubric. This is the second of our forums on the election and the stakes of the election for civic engagement. And beginning in November, we'll have a series of three forums about, on the theme of Maine in a transnational world. Stay tuned for more publicity about that. In all of the civic forums, we like to bring distinguished advocates, experts, voices on important issues. Typically, they're the distinguished visitors from off campus. Tonight, we have distinguished speakers from on campus. We wanted to have a panel of student voices talking about the stakes of the presidential election from their point of view. Students who are active in a variety of different issues, activities, activisms, coming from different places, having different kinds of political concerns, and to have a dialogue among them and with you about what, especially for young voters, seem like the stakes and the significance of the presidential campaign. I should be clear that when Peggy Rotondo of our center and I came up with the idea of this panel and reached out to students, what we didn't want to have happen was kind of a blue side, red side debate, and you won't get that tonight. We didn't ask who people were supporting. We weren't interested in balance or imbalance. We weren't thinking about advocating for one or the other of the candidates. What we did want to have was a conversation about the importance of this campaign from the point of view of thoughtful students who were passionate and committed and active on a variety of different issues. And having planned this panel with our panelists tonight, I know that you will get that, and I'm very, very excited about it. Before I introduce the panelists, a little bit of business. First of all, some thanks that are due. I want to thank Kristen Cloutier and Brenda Pelletier, and especially Peggy Rotondo from the Harward Center for Community Partnerships for helping to organize this panel and for helping us do the logistics of making it work. Thanks also to Campus Media Services for helping to arrange the audio and videotaping of this discussion, and to Maine Public Broadcasting Network, which generally rebroadcasts these civic forums in their Speaking in Maine series, and I expect this one to be broadcast as well. Thanks also to our friends from the Lewiston Sun Journal for being here tonight to cover this discussion. My thanking of MPBN is a reminder to let you know that if, as I hope, you take part in the discussion tonight, as it's going to be recorded and rebroadcast, we would like you to come and sign two different permission slips which enable us to reuse the recording that's made tonight. If you're not willing to sign that permission slip, we ask that you not be part of the conversation because we'll have to kind of bleep you out or edit you out, and really, we really want it to be as robust as possible, but we hope that you will sign the permissions and be part of the conversation. So let me introduce our panel and tell you about the format for tonight. First of all, and I'm going to introduce them in order of proximity to me, Theodore Sutherland is a sophomore majoring in economics and French and doing a concentration in globalization. Theodore is from Accra, Ghana. He's particularly interested in economic development of developing countries and international relations, especially between first world countries and Africa. He has an interest in environmental issues and conditions, including global warming, that result from economic practices due to globalization. Rachel Curzius is a junior concentrating in both English and women and gender studies. She's from Ridgewood, New Jersey. She has a strong commitment to political work on issues of gender equality. She's co-president of the Feminist Action Coalition and also serves as equity officer for the Brooks Quimby Debate Council. Marshall Hatch, also a junior, is a politics major and religion minor. Marshall comes from Chicago. He's got wide-ranging interests in issues of community development and law. And in this campaign, he's especially attuned to the effects of the election on the composition of the Supreme Court and on issues such as abortion rights. And finally, Emily Grady is a junior environmental studies major from Littleton, Massachusetts, especially interested in social responses to environmental issues. She's active in a range of environmentally themed organizations and initiatives, including the Bates Energy Action Movement, BEAM, the Environmental Coalition, the Bates Contemplates Food Initiative, and others. Next semester, she'll be studying abroad in Nicaragua. On graduation, Emily hopes to do community or political work related to environmental issues. Our format for tonight is not meant to be a series of talking heads kind of giving monologue panel presentations, but a conversation, first of all, amongst the panel, and then I think after a while with you as well. I'm going to pose an initial question or two for all of the panelists. They've been invited, after they each launch into their first answers, to talk with each other. I may stick in another question or two, but our hopes is to have as free-flowing and robust a conversation as possible. So let me start with an initial question for all four of our panelists. What, from your point of view, are some of the most important stakes of the election? What difference do you see the election making on key issues or policies that you think are most important? Theodore, start us off.
Good evening, everybody. From my perspective, coming from the international side of things, specifically Ghana, I don't want to speak for everybody, I think that these elections particularly show American politics in a new sense. I think this is a point at which I, for example, I'm having a cultural and political experience about the American society. Now, these depictions have come through how the media puts a spin on things, how the media talks about certain issues, what is emphasized by the politicians, what you hear that American citizens want to hear, what the middle class is like. It's really just an exploration of the culture and a new exposure to the world of what America in the 21st century looks like.
Thank you.
Well, when I look at this election and I try to figure out exactly, especially being a women and gender studies major and trying to figure out what is it at stake for women, I think that the main question that I have to ask myself is, what is a women's issue? I think that it's really easy to immediately ascribe it to the idea of reproductive rights, or like, I don't know how Sarah Palin did on SNL the other night, but I think that it's much more important to recognize that there might not be one universal cause that all women can agree upon, particularly across divisions of race, age, socioeconomic class, like level of education, things like that. Even the idea of reproductive rights, it's something that doesn't affect all women. It doesn't affect lesbians, postmenopausal women, things like this. So when you look at what is it that affects a woman's status in society, things like poverty, elderly care, welfare, wage equity, education, prison policies, immigration. These are things that we also have to look at, and we need to have politicians who recognize the interconnectedness of these issues and how they relate to one another and affect all of the populace.
Thanks, Rachel. I was very fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with my family, especially my dad, when I went home for the summer. And one Saturday morning, he woke me up and took me to a press conference. And the press conference was basically proposed by the Chicago Urban League, and they were filing suit against the Illinois State Board of Education. And basically, the lawsuit was about the restructuring of the public school education in Illinois. The funding in Illinois simply is based off of property taxes. So you have these regions in Chicago, suburban regions, majority white demographically, and they pay obviously a higher property tax because the property values are higher. And on the other side, you have regions that are obviously, you know, lower economic regions and majority minority. So basically, what me and my father did, and I enjoyed the experience, was he helped me to understand, you know, how important education was. And I know that education is a state issue, but to me, education should be invested in more. And Barack Obama, for me, has convinced me that as president, he's going to fund it more. And so education, the image of America globally, the image of African Americans in general, could be changed and altered as a result of this election. And as Mr. Scobie mentioned, the face of the Supreme Court could possibly change as a result of this election. So just a few things.
Thanks, Marsha.
I'm not sure. I think a number of people that are here this evening were also at Naomi Oreskes' talk the other night, but I just want to reiterate one point that she made to begin, and that's that, especially with regard to global warming, the science consensus on science is in, and it's something that scientists across the board agree is happening, and that it's anthropogenic, human-made. And really the thing that's blocking policy, or that's blocking change, is policy and politics. And so that's one of the issues that I think is really at the heart of this election. And addressing environmental issues will be a huge task for our next president, and something that really has to be prioritized. And I just want to say two things that I think sort of stem from this issue. And the first is that environmental issues underlie a lot of other issues that our country is facing right now, in terms of including the financial crisis and foreign policy, gas prices, and really energy is at the heart of this. And so I think we all are aware that the financial crisis has dominated the news for the past few weeks, and not too many solutions have been presented, but one way to look at a potential way to alleviate some of the financial crisis is through investing in green jobs and alternative energy sources, which also addresses reliance on foreign fuels and sort of the image of America in international politics. So these are all things that people are concerned about. Politics, the politicians are talking about them, and they're sort of at the heart of these international issues as global warming and other environmental issues. And then aside from simply the way that environmental issues connect to the broader political issues, it can't be denied that climate change is going to affect all of us, our children and our grandchildren, and that's something that I'm really passionate about. And since 1900, there's already been a one degree increase in temperature of the Earth's surface, and that's a really revealing and sort of like should be a motivating fact for us to make policy and to elect a politician that will make policy to address that issue. So, and just to close, I think that both candidates have presented progressive climate change policies that we haven't seen in recent years. The same, I don't think, can be said for the vice presidential candidates, but it is good news that wherever we go at this point, there will be some changes, I think.
The four of you have all raised really important questions, and there are things in what each of you have said that I want to come back to, issues of race and class divisions that Marshall brought up, of international relations. But I think the first thing I'd like to ask you to think about is to build on Emily's comment, to build on both Rachel's comment about the interconnectedness of issues and Emily's thinking through the relationship between her own passion for environmental issues and climate change and the economic crisis. One of the things that's changed since the time in the late summer when Peggy Rotundo and I first thought, let's have a student panel on the election, is we now find ourselves in an economic crisis as deep as any since the Great Depression. And if we think about the interconnections of all these concerns, I'm interested in how you see the effect of the economic crisis on these issues that you are most passionate about. How does it make you think differently, if it does, about what's needed? Emily's to a certain extent already talked about that. Someone else jump in.
Sure, to a certain extent, as I was emphasizing before, education has been downplayed as a result of the economic crisis. It took the third and final debate for the moderator to finally bring out each education proposal from each candidate. And we finally found out that McCain is for vouchers to expand the Washington, D.C. voucher program that was initiated in 2004, and Obama is supporting charter schools. So, as I said earlier, you know, the economic crisis has caused education and other important issues to be downplayed and kept under the surface a little bit.
Marshall, do you see the economic crisis as something that's basically just a setback for the education? Are there any openings for policy change and for the election transforming issues, or does it mean that we have to put everything else that we care about on hold?
I think a little bit of both. I think a little bit of both. I don't know.
Other thoughts about this?
I think what Marshall said just led me to think that America has had to redefine their priorities following this economic crisis. I'm sad about the economic crisis, obviously, for the effect it's had on the economy and the people who it's affecting, but for the reason that it's causing the country to rethink how they need to structure their country and the institutions they have, the people they need to lead the country, the kind of ideas they need, and the reform that is needed. I think that's a great stride in the advancement of a society. I think it's good for the world to see that this kind of advancement. Another thing I wanted to touch on was the obvious interconnection across borders economically of America and how it's affected Europe over the economic crisis over the last few weeks. It has affected Africa in its own way. One of the more prominent ways would be obviously in the Millennium Development Goals. We get aid from America, which is a big, they support us a lot in terms of giving us financial aid. This is obviously going to drop. And so Africans are, from our perspective, looking at the elections as, okay, so who's going to give us the biggest aid if the people win? Like, what is going to happen to us? They're looking at the outcome of the election based from that perspective. Another interesting perspective that I think because I'm not back home, I just hear this, but like, for example, Kenya and Obama's family history in Kenya, they are very proud of their country at this point in time. And for me, I heard a lot of talk about how, like, Obama is representing the African-American, but I haven't heard anything about how he's representing, like, the African side of things. And it's just interesting to hear back home, like, people are, Africans are excited about Obama becoming, having the possibility of becoming a president, because it means a reform in how America has developed over the years to actually, at this point, have, give a black man, not an African-American, but a black man, the opportunity to come this far, and a woman as well, which is Clinton, less so Palin, but more of Clinton, thing there. But I think it's just, that was, for me, that was just an interesting insight into the elections from my perspective.
I'm going to come back in a second to something Marshall brought up, but Rachel, did you want to speak to this question of economic crisis?
I think that what you were just saying about the idea that the economic crisis really makes people recognize that we have to restructure the way that we work on our economy, I think works on multiple levels. The idea of restructuring and seeing that deregulation doesn't work feeds into a lot of different ideas, especially pertaining to women, the idea that we're not all on an equal playing field, and that assuming that we are and just allowing kind of this idea of a free market doesn't end up working. It ultimately ends up hurting a lot of people. So I think that the idea of regulation on a larger scale is ultimately a positive one. But in terms of the economic crisis itself and what and the problems it creates in the present, most of the impoverished families, the heads of households, are just single women. So in terms of poverty, the people who bear the brunt of poverty are women, single women, particularly minority women, who have been just structurally they've been structurally barred from really achieving greater heights. And I think that as with greater poverty only compounds all of the poverty that's already placed upon women. So in terms of the economic crisis, particularly as it pertains to families, in looking at the ways that we can improve upon it, maybe create better health care, decrease the burden upon single women in particular, I think that both candidates have to recognize that it's not a simple fix. It's not simply putting, let's say, $750 billion back into the economy and seeing what happens. We need to work on serious regulation and seeing how that regulation is and what the consequence of that regulation is going to be for all of the people and not just the people who hold the power in the status quo.
I'm hearing two different, I think, right answers to this question. What difference does the economic crisis make to these other issues? One is anxiety that it will set back efforts at policy change that you care about that require resources. But on the other hand, the sense that there may be an opening for completely revamping the way we think about certain issues, whether it's our place in the international order or social and economic regulations. And like, let me pose one more economic crisis question to you and the election, which is to ask you to think about this question from the point of view of young people of your generation facing a new future which is much more economically challenged. I'm not assuming any of you represent the young or the college voter, but you've got to, I'm sure, see this crisis from the standpoint of where you are generationally. And I wonder how it affects your sense of what your political future will be and how you will need to respond as young citizens. Go for it, Emma.
Well, just to sort of reiterate on what I was mentioning before, that of course we're all going to be graduating in a few years or at the end of this year, and we're going to be looking for jobs and trying to figure out how we're going to fit into this economy and what's going on in the world right now. And I think that from an environmental perspective anyway, the potential for creating a huge amount of green collar or green jobs in the United States, and that can't be outsourced and they have to stay within our boundaries because of the technology that we have, and because if they're structured to be that way, then they can stay that way, depending on who our next president is. I think that there's huge potential there for, as I was saying before, sort of trying to bounce us back out of this economic crisis, but also create new structures, a little bit like Rachel was talking about, to enable young people to find jobs, to enable so many people that don't have jobs now and can't get a job to get one because of investing in these green jobs.
Other thoughts about this question of the crisis from the point of view of your generation?
I think that if anything, it just increases the feelings of distrust that I feel, at least, like our generation has been bred on in terms of looking at politics and politicians. I know that growing up, and I guess the cliche of the crooked politician has always existed, but I feel like it's almost expected that our politicians are going to somehow mislead us or work in their own best interests as opposed to the interests of the larger community. And if anything, I think that the economic crisis and everyone trying to point fingers at other people just is a really good example of how the greed, I think that everyone's greed really plays into it, and the idea that just the lack of forward thought that has really, at least summarizes to me, most of probably the policy and the politics that I remember throughout my entire lifetime. I think that if anything, it just continues to breed this mistrust that we have for the government. And I think that that's why our generation right now is becoming so involved in politics, because we're recognizing this need to change and to break out of all of the ideas that we've had up until this point about how politicians should work and who they should be working for.
Marshall, I saw you nodding.
Yeah, I concur, but I just think, and I sense a restructuring of American politics, like through the lens of like partisanship. Like this generation is less partisan, much, much less partisan than prior generations, and I see this kind of mesh, and what Theo was talking about is priorities, we reestablishing our priorities or prioritizing, you know, what issues matter most to us. And I think ideologies of Republicans, who's a Republican and who's a Democrat, means much less to this generation than it did to previous generations. So I kind of sense that in a way.
Theodore raised in his last comment the importance of Obama across different dimensions as potentially the first African American candidate, as someone of African descent. Certainly, there's a lot of evidence that he's galvanized young voters to identify with the political process and have an alternative to cynicism. I'm wondering what any of you think about the importance of Obama as a new leader and a potential new president, and maybe answer that question: whether or not he wins the election. What does it mean either for race relations or political culture in our country?
The mere fact that he's a self-identified African American to a certain extent has reified what African American male means globally. I remember, you know, my older sister, she's coming back from Singapore. She was teaching in Singapore, and she told me the stories of what they thought being black or being an African American and what that culture meant over there. And, you know, it's not a lot of people who look like me over there, so all they can do is look at the images that they see in the media, on television, and base that off of what they think African Americans is. So I think it offers an alternative to in a way, this hip-hop culture. Because another story, I'm gonna stop with stories, but
stories are good. Go for it.
Another story. When I went home in Chicago, I worked with my father in his church, did some community organizing, and I had a chance to bond with 10 to 13 African American males, young boys, and you know, when they were 5 and 6, all they saw were these hip hop images, and I guess the mantra that they lived by was get rich or die trying. And so this thug mentality was the only way to get out of the ghetto or the hood. So I think Barack Obama, as a self-identified black man, offers this positive image that they can, you know, I can be like him if I wanted to because he looks like me.
I want to ask other members of the panel who want to speak to this to talk about the potentially transformative meaning or effect of the Obama candidacy. But before I do, I just want to say now's the time to be thinking about joining the conversation and putting your hand up and posing questions and comments to us. But other folks on the panel.
Well, I can't help but think about even all of the positive benefits that you guys are talking about. I think that there's still a huge problem of representation, of deciding that any, or not deciding, but the fact that in any disadvantaged group, the one person who is elevated above becomes the spokesperson for that group. So in terms of in this election, I'm thinking, I mean, I think that Barack Obama is a great example of something that any African-American male or woman would want to attain to. But when I think, for example, I'm not going to name names, but about female politicians who have entered the realm and I think that the way that they've been presented in the media as the idea about if this one woman doesn't do well or does do well, then that bodes poorly or bodes well for all female politicians. And that for any disenfranchised group or any group that has felt like they haven't had entirely a say, that their entire future in politics depends on the success or failure of this one candidate. And in terms of women especially, I mean, elephant in the room, Sarah Palin, who just, whether or not you agree with her politics, the way that she's been portrayed in the media has certainly showed that people don't think or are unwilling to think about female candidates outside of a certain realm or outside of a certain spectrum simply because they're female candidates, and that all female candidates from here on out are compared to the Hillary Clintons and the Sarah Palins. And I think that there's a problem with that.
Rachel, just talk a little bit more, and again, no one's asking you to represent women or a woman's attitude in this way, but from your point of view about the significance of both Clinton and Palin for changes in political culture or changes in gender attitudes this year. It's been an extraordinary election across all of these differences when an African-American man and two female candidates have played such a transformative role.
Well, first of all, I think it's tremendous that not only one but two women were able to make it so far in the election, especially coming from different parties and representing entirely different beliefs. I think that that's fantastic, and I think that it's an incredible thing to be a woman watching this election. It's empowering in general, but when you look at the way that the women have been represented in the media, I think that they show the dichotomy that the media always represents women in, which is the idea where you're either a bookish, smart woman who has absolutely no sexuality, or you're a highly sexualized figure in the media who's known more for how you look and how you present yourself than what you actually have to say. So in terms of showing women in general, I think it's fantastic that there are women who are at the forefront of this election, but the way that the women are presented, I take issue with.
Any other thoughts about Obama's significance or the significance of the candidates in general as a moment of change in our political culture?
I think what Marshall said, that how far Obama has come also speaks to the stereotype of African Americans globally on a global level, because I think that Obama coming this far has reformed the has given a new stereotype for African Americans, or a new standard that I think wasn't there before. Well, from my perspective, I just think it's great.
I just have one comment to add to, and I think it's from sort of a symbolic perspective. I think that what Obama has to offer, like his message has been all along, is change. But the idea that I think Americans are maybe more willing, and the international community as well, maybe more willing to accept somewhat drastic changes compared to, because of this new candidate, because on a physical level, maybe he looks different than past candidates. He's African American, his message has been changed. And I think that this has sort of set a tone for what his presidency will offer, and that if he's elected, more people will be expecting greater things because of what he's run on this whole time, and because of who he is. But I think just sort of on a very symbolic level that could play out as well.
One last question, and then I'm going to really invite comments from the audience. What if McCain wins? All of these issues of change will still be on the table. Change in regulation in the economy, change in our relationships to the world, grappling with global warming. What are your thoughts about what's opened up for a new kind of politics or new policies in a McCain administration? Silence. Emily, I want to ask you that, since you know that both of them at least have committed in their platforms to your most passionate issue.
Yeah,
on climate change.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. They both have, actually have all their platforms right in front of me, but they have both committed to cap and trade systems and supporting alternative energy and developing fuel efficient cars and a fuel efficient economy. And so they have both committed to a number of the key elements of progressive climate change legislation. But first of all, I think one of the major, all along McCain has been a relatively green candidate comparatively to the other Republican candidates that he was running against in the primaries. And but I think what has really changed his standing, especially from the eyes of environmentalists, is his selection as Palin as his running mate, she has openly said that, she said a number of different things. One is that climate change is perhaps not man-made, that it is occurring, but what are we to do about it, because it's not necessarily our responsibility. And also McCain's platform to increase drilling and Palin's encouragement of this as well, I think, in Anwar and other offshore drilling, I think also indicates sort of perhaps that he's started to take a different path on the environmental front, that's different from where he's stood for the past number of years. So it raises questions for me about, if he's elected, where else is he going to sort of change his positions, change his beliefs on core issues like this?
Any other thoughts about what difference it would be in terms of change, new directions for a McCain presidency?
Well, I was looking also at just all their different platforms before I came, and they each have a little drop-down menu on their website that says issues. And then it gives you all the different issues, like welfare, poverty, all of these different things. And when I looked at Barack Obama's, there was a special section on women, and it talked about it. It was pretty comprehensive. And I went to McCain's website, and there were a lot of issues there, but the idea of women wasn't one of them. The closest I saw to that was the idea of the sanctity of life and bodily dignity, which is certainly a way to approach, but I think that, I mean, no. I think that, not that he's not looking at women's issues in a comprehensive way, but it certainly didn't show on his website, so. but not to be bipartisan, because not that he's not looking at those issues, but I just didn't see them apparent in any way.
No. A lot's on the table. We've been talking about the significance of the Obama candidacy along different dimensions, about the economic crisis, the way this election looks from a generational point of view. Let me invite thoughts, questions, responses, your own answers from members of the audience. Yes, and thank you. Come to the microphone.
Good evening. Thank you. My name is Christopher Ray. I'm the president of the Secular Student Alliance on campus.
Of the which alliance?
The Secular Student Alliance on campus. And one issue that I think ties very closely to all of the issues that we've discussed that's very important to me is science advocacy. One thing that we all know is that the U.S. has fallen far behind in science in a number of ways. We lost the race for the Large Hadron Collider. We've lost the race for the carbon nanotube. We've lost the race for the space elevator. And these issues aren't just science issues. They're profoundly economic issues, I think. I think that Barack Obama especially has made a very clear point on his platform to be a firm advocate for incentivizing science education in a way that is not just talking about making America look smart again, but about making science profitable again, which I think is an excellent solution to any kind of economic crisis when you have a firm, solid base for advancing technology and for advancing science. And I am fully aware that it's a bit dangerous for a candidate these days to come off as sounding too pro-science, because as we know, over the past 10 years or so, things got a bit ugly in the evolution versus creationism debate, which turned off a lot of voters to anything having to do with science. But one of the other reasons that science is as important is in the framing of the global warming question and of climate change. These are issues that are very important to one of the panelists and that are probably important in some way to all of us. And I think it would, that at least from our generation's perspective, it would be very helpful for all of us if the candidates would do a better job cementing a position very clearly about what are they going to do in terms of college-level science education, what are they going to do in terms of high school-level science education to make sure that we have an American workforce that is scientifically literate, that's competitive, and that has the information needed to solve these problems that are at their core, even if they're social problems on one level, like global warming and things like that, they are profoundly science problems. And these are problems that can only be solved by the advancement of science. And I think that all of us here would benefit very greatly from having a candidate who was much clearer an advocate for science and for improving science education in America.
Thanks. Any thoughts and responses?
Well, I think that there needs to be an incentivization for women to be more of a part of the science and math field than there is currently. Of all the people getting bachelor's and master's and PhDs in engineering and science, only 12% of them, 12 or 13% of them are women. So I think that any candidate that's able to find, and I think that a lot of that occurs just through both structural all sorts of just like structural and subtle discrimination that occurs. So a candidate who's able to find a way through, I think, monetary incentives, scholarships, things like that, those are for men and women, particularly for women.
Emily.
to add on to that, I think one thing that America has prided ourselves on for a lot of our history has been scientific innovation and sort of innovation and creativity in general that is something I think for a number of years distinguished the American economy and American academia, or even just liberal arts education is an example of that, of valuing a creative approach to learning and to furthering our education and our economy. And just to connect it to the environmental issues again, I think that if more investment in science and technology will rapidly increase the available alternative energy sources that we have, ability to harness wind power and water and hydropower and a number of other alternative energy sources, and develop much more efficient ways to develop alternative energy. So I think that's a really, really good point to bring up, that we need to invest in sciences. And all the way, I mean, this is a point maybe we'll get to in a little while, but all the way through from kindergarten and through our public school systems, through college and beyond, that's it will definitely further our and support our economy and further our investment in alternative energy sources as well.
Other thoughts, questions?
Hi. You all touched on a little bit about how Obama inspires people and how he will inspire black people in particular to rise above structural racism in this country. I sometimes fear that because Obama has risen above the structural racism, that perhaps it will lead other Americans to believe that there is not structural racism in this country, or that we now live in a colorblind society. I'd just like to hear you guys comment.
Can I, before we ask the panelists to comment, it's a very important point that you've made. What would be the evidence, one way or the other, for you that either an Obama presidency would foster more attention to different forms of overcoming racism, or that it was a kind of a narcotic that was lulling us into thinking?
I think what I was thinking is that perhaps programs that are based in communities to kind of battle the issues within inner cities and within and within black neighborhoods in general, like a lot of programs being stripped, or I think this is a similar argument made against something like reparations, where that people fear that once that there's this kind of very visible proof that it is possible to succeed in spite of racism, that we no longer really have to worry about it. Is that?
That's great. Thank you. Thoughts about this, sort of a cautionary or worried reading of an Obama victory. Marshall, I'm looking at you because you were thinking about the links between issues of race and class inequality in urban neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's a very good question. The question made me think of Obama's Father's Day speech. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. But basically, the speech was simply about personal responsibility within the black community particularly. So I don't really know how to answer that question, but if I were teaching a group of young African-American males, I would tell them, yes, Barack Obama has shown us that he's able to excel academically and able to beat stereotypes or destroy the stereotypes of African-American males. But at the same time, you have to be accountable and responsible for yourself, excel. You know, given that speech, I think we'll go a long way. And
One of the themes that's run through your conversation on the panel so far is issues that are dividing us, or in which there are genuine conflicts that we need to overcome, conflicts of inequality or conflicts of cultural values, for instance, over the science question, and issues that really require us, like climate change or international relations, to develop new forms of unity, to work together in new ways. I wonder what your thoughts are about what effect the election is having on the divisions and the unities in American politics. It seems to me we've got good evidence for both, some moments of incredible polarization and some moments where people are crossing lines that didn't seem crossable before. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think I have a couple thoughts about that. One is, I think I made a comment sort of about this at the last civic engagement series, and it's sort of one thing I've noticed at Bates and sort of in broader community politics in general is that that people do pick these issues that they're really passionate about and sort of stay in this narrow path, sticking to those issues, working as an activist or some sort of community organizer on those issues, and really staying within that realm. For example, like I've definitely done that with an emphasis on the environment here, and but I also think that because sort of like we were talking about earlier, that people are perhaps less inclined in our generation to stick to partisan lines, by focusing on these issues, that people can sort of pick and choose what they really care about, and that might sort of break partisan boundaries and be a little bit more, I mean, in some ways it's restructuring, in some ways it's stratified, in other ways it's unifying, but I think that's a one way to look at it, that because people are picking issues and groups and ideologies that they're really passionate about, it may turn, we may come to a point where people are really voting on a few particular issues and then looking for a candidate that supports those viewpoints. So I'm not sure if that gets at it a little bit.
It does. Marshall, were you?
Sure. I think within each identity, you know, you have a certain set of priorities. And as we stated before, these priorities have been altered and restructured for the most part. A perfect example is the identity of evangelicals in America. I'm a religion minor, and last short term, I wrote a 20-page paper about the effect of evangelicals on past elections and the possible effect they'll have on this election. And what I found was younger evangelicals are starting to vote on issues such as the economy, on global warming, and less on issues such as abortion or issues that are bound to divide us. So I think if we focus on the issues that bring us together and less on the issues that divide us, then we'll go a long way.
Do you guys share what I thought I understood in Emily's comment and maybe Marshall's earlier comment, that your generation is more practical, more problem-oriented, a little bit more immune from the culture wars divides, which is a hopeful thing in the sense that as you inherit our politics, they'll be more boundary crossing. Does that seem right?
Yes.
Other thoughts?
Hi, thank you guys for speaking tonight. It's been a great talk so far. But I think that the issue we've been talking about for the last couple of questions is just this sense of divisiveness within American politics right now. And I think a lot of that, at least for me, is coming out of the lack of substantive debate in the actual campaigns. And it seems like the real issues that we could come together on are continually getting swept under the rug by each politician trying to pigeonhole the other one into these certain identities that they may or may not represent. And even if they do represent, it shouldn't really be taken into account. What really brought this out for me was listening to Colin Powell's speech the other day that he gave endorsing Obama. But just some examples would be Barack Obama continually berating McCain for voting with George Bush on every issue. You know, sure, he has voted with him on a lot of issues, but that doesn't mean he can't change. And then on the same whole, just all of the type of the slander and the true things about Barack Obama concerning his pastors, concerning his religious identity, his race, his names, has just been really ridiculous for me. So I was wondering what changes for the last couple weeks of this election and for future elections do you guys propose, so which would enable politicians to kind of rise above these divisive issues that we shouldn't be voting on, and allow them to kind of speak for this sense of public good that at least I would like to be focusing on this election, and like just kind of an efficient running of our society, and really act like I think a true politician should act.
That's a great challenge, and I'm going to kick it to our panelists.
I think that's a supreme challenge. I don't know if it's one that the first thing that came to my mind is maybe you could ban negative ads or something like that, or at least incentivize, or I think that what would actually be incredible is if the news companies decided, like just like they decided that they would no longer allow cigarette ads to be on the television, if they no longer allowed negative ads to be on the television. Something like that, some sort of a really positive, definitive stand on how negative campaigning actually harms the people involved as well as the politicians would be great. But also, I think that the media in general has to hold every politician to the same standard. I'm just thinking about the vice presidential debate and how it was more about like survival of the debate than actually talking and hashing out issues. So I think that if we're going to have something where we need to, where people can come together and create a constructive form of debate and discourse, then everyone needs to be held to the same standard for helping to create that discourse.
Other thoughts about how to make our political culture less toxic in elections?
I'd like to talk about that. Excuse me for my absence, sorry. Yet again, coming at it from the cultural side of things, that the aggressive nature of the political campaigns that I have seen, I have never been exposed to before, because politics back home is obviously quite different. And for me, my initial impression, and still is that the American politics so far seems to be more of why the other person shouldn't be president and why I should be president. And even as I watched the debates, like, some of the questions weren't answered, and I felt like this is what the people need to know, but you people are still just having bitty arguments about who is related to who, and it was just things for me that the people, I mean, it's important that they hear about, but at this point in time, this is what needs to be addressed, and that is not being done. So it talks to me about a culture of putting the other person down in a different way, and more about competition than actually satisfying what you're there for.
Yeah, I'm kind of optimistic. Each generation recreates, the culture, in this context, American culture. So as we stated earlier, this generation is more, meshed or mixed or willing to reach across the aisle. So I'm kind of optimistic, and I was kind of troubled to see in the last debate that the candidates talked more about Joe the Plumber than they did education, which I'm very passionate about. So, again, I'm very optimistic, but at the same time, I think it's a very serious issue. Thank you for bringing that up.
Do we need new? Part of the implication of the question, and also of Rachel's answer about negative ads, is that we have a political media system that tends to be, I don't know, a race to the bottom or a race to the trivial. How might we imagine a different way that elections and media interact that would not necessarily be less conflictual, but be more substantive and more mindful? We're asking you to solve all the big problems involved.
I think that an emphasis on the actual issues by the media, they get at it sometimes, but even commentary after the debates are much more superficial. And I think that if the media is going to, a positive role the media could play instead of that superficial sort of analysis would be a much more looking at specific issues like climate change and really hash out the positions of each candidate. And there are a few good news sources that do that, but they're few and far between. And so I think that a clear analysis of different issues, and I think what has been really frustrating for a lot of us as we've watched the debates is how it's like a he said, she said type of argument, and constantly one politician will be saying, well, I only voted on X amount of bills in this, so somebody will say that he voted for something, the other guy will say, no, he didn't, I didn't. It's back and forth. And so I think that that type of banter is not constructive at all. And we need to, if the media is going to play a role, it really, really has to focus on particular issues and sort of almost ignore that sort of not very substantive type of debate.
I'm interested in folks in the audience have thoughts about how, you know, how we make the political culture seem less toxic, less trivial. And I also have one of these middle-aged generation questions, which is to what extent are new social media, the internet, blogging, Facebook, do they make a difference, positive or negative, in lifting the tone of our politics or in not lifting it?
So I can't talk about social networking media because I'm essentially middle-aged myself. But the thing that I keep coming back to, and I have heard this a number of times tonight, starting, I think, Marshall, with your comment about how this generation is less partisan than other generations have been. And it keeps bouncing me back to the discussion that I think of as patently ridiculous, and I mean that in the original sense, worthy of ridicule, this dialogue that's been happening in the media over the last few days about pro-American and anti-American places. The thing that I keep coming back to is the incredible hopefulness, the great potential embedded in a dialogue that would actually enable us to say what we mean when we talk about America. What makes us proud about this country? You know, we use words like patriotism and pro-American, but we use them in the context of a pretty spiteful, I don't know about the rest of you, I've been staggered by the level of hate in this campaign. It's really disappointing, let's put it simply. And I guess one of the things that I'm curious about is, you know, given the lack of dialogue about what we mean when we talk about America and what we really hope for, what we believe in terms of this country, it left me curious as to what you all think. What are the aspects of America that you want our new leader to stand up for, to bring forth, to hold up?
I think maybe the first, or maybe the most important thing in being pro-America or in trying to really embody the values that we like to think our country was founded on is the recognition that it's not a perfect society. As soon as we recognize that it's not perfect and that it's something that, and that we can be proud of what America has accomplished so far, but also on how much further there is to go, and that the actual structures that America has created so far are flawed in themselves. And I think that the first politician that really has the courage to say, listen, the structures that have even brought me as far as I've gone have limited so many other people from getting even close to where I am. And actually going back and looking at those structures and really trying to fix them. Because going back to even your question about the different forms of media, I was astounded by, first of all, the internet is crazy and amazing in many ways. I think that it's such an incredible opportunity to have this completely democratic form of media where anyone really has a chance to get up on a soapbox and say whatever they want to say. But that being said, I'm so disappointed at oftentimes how that form of media has been used and abused, even in the way that it's, how I can't think of that many positive websites or Facebook groups I've seen about many candidates, but I can think of so many negative ones. And it's the negative ones that really are the ones that are garnering attention and garnering hits. So in terms of trying to figure out exactly how we can embody American values, I think it's to first understand that we aren't entirely embodying them now and how we can work towards fixing that.
Talking about American values, I found it particularly interesting at the points in the campaign where Obama was said to be Muslim, and there was a whole, it seemed like America had a problem with that. So for me, then, at that point in time, the election not only became about divisions along race, but also along religion. So what if he was Muslim? So what, you would vote for him because of his religion? The values in the American system, I think, just came out during this point in the election campaign. And I'm a little disappointed as to how that went down. But I hope that somebody would raise the issue at some point and discuss it.
Colin Powell's endorsement of Obama, I think, was notable for his discussion of the photograph of the mother grieving her dead soldiers, her dead son who was a soldier's loss, and he's a Muslim, and it was an astonishing moment that he called, I think, everyone out for not having said, so what if Obama was a Muslim? What's so wrong about that? But I think you're right that it took a lot. It took someone not involved in the campaign directly to be able to say that. We're still stuck inside those confines.
My name's Matt. I'm a supporter of Senator McCain. I guess I want to pick up on a question that was asked earlier. I'm not going to say that I was stunned when you asked what would change if Senator McCain became elected. Mrs. Grady bringing up the climate change issue was one of them, but being a McCain supporter, I wanted to bring up a couple of issues. The Democrats have done a great job of labeling John McCain as George Bush's third term. I guess if that's true, last time I checked, President Bush had an approval rating of 27%, according to the Washington Post. And in a Gallup poll that came out today, he was getting 46% of the vote of registered voters. I guess a couple things I wanted to point out was John McCain's record of bipartisanship, which we have not seen from President Bush. He has had the benefit of working with a Republican Congress until 2006, and then having a Democratic Congress came in, of which we can say not much has happened, to say it nicely. Senator McCain has a record of reaching across the aisle in terms of campaign finance reform with Senator Feingold and working to make elections so that a candidate cannot buy their way into politics. Another example would be McCain-Kennedy on comprehensive immigration reform, and I didn't want to sit here and just, when people were saying, well, he's just Bush's third term, when clearly he is not George Bush's third term, and they like to run that ad of 2003 when he said, I voted with President Bush 90% of the time, which Senator McCain has a clear record of breaking with the Republican establishment, of reaching across the aisle. One of his best friends is Senator Joe Lieberman, who has been out campaigning with him, who has been a lifelong Democrat, who has continuously reached across the aisle with Senator McCain. I just wanted to point that out. And I guess my question is, why do people overlook his record of bipartisanship and why he is seen as President Bush's third term?
Before I invite panelists and others to answer it, let me say the reason why I asked that was precisely not to have us assume that one candidate was going to bring change and the other one wasn't, but to have us imagine what different kinds of changes each of the candidates would bring. So many thanks to you for giving your answer to those questions. And stay up there for a second, but does anyone want to take on the question that was asked? Why, from the point of view of a supporter of McCain, McCain's genuine changes or prospects for change tend to be ignored?
Well, first of all, I think Senator McCain made it very clear that he wasn't George Bush in the third debate when he said, I'm not George Bush. If you wanted to run against George Bush, you should have ran 4 years ago. But I think you answered it in your statement. You know, Democrats have done a great job framing McCain as, you know, Bush's third term. He voted for Bush 90% of the time. But again, I think a lot of it has to do with McCain's 26 years being in the Senate, although Joe Biden has been in the Senate 30 years. I think McCain is framed as an insider. Obama is more, you know, framed as an outsider. So I think a lot of it has to do with that. A lot of it is, you know, the likability heuristic. You know, people like Obama more than they like John McCain. They may think John McCain is too old to be president, and Sarah Palin might be president if, you know, John McCain doesn't finish his first term. So, I mean, it's just a lot of stuff. But I think it was a great question.
I'd like to pose maybe a question, and the reason I asked you to stay up at the microphone is I'd love to have you
kick off an answer to it and then ask every one of the panelists to give their answer as we come a bit to an end and to invite answers from other people. And here's the question. Regardless of whom you're supporting and with all of the reasons you might have for your support, do you view this election as a historic election, a moment of important change? You know, there's some elections like the election of Reagan in 1980 or the election of John Kennedy in 1960, where as kind of historians of our own moment, we think, yeah, history took a new turn in there. And I'm interested how you perceive the moment that we're living through. Whether it's going to be one of those punctuation marks. And if you do, what do you think are going to be the key changes that happen? So start us off in answering that.
Well, I remember this is the first election I've ever been able to vote in. I somewhat remember 2004. I was somewhat involved, but not really, and don't remember 2000. But I think this is the most important election of all time. We're facing an economic crisis of great proportions. We're in the middle of a war fighting an enemy that we know what part of the world they are, but it's the first time we're fighting an enemy where we don't know what they look like, where it's not a distinct battleground where we're here and our enemy's over there and we need to go fight them. It's completely different that we've got national security being brought up, education's being brought up, climate change. There's just so many issues in this election that's unlike any other. I think that's what's going to make this campaign in this election the most important ever.
And from your, I think that's a great framing of the question. From your point of view, if your guy wins, what will be the most important change he can bring? Is it about terrorism? Is it about climate change? Is it about the economic crisis?
I think one of the most important changes he could make was an economic crisis. I admire Senator Obama and everything he's done through this election, but I guess part of me is no society has ever been able to function while cutting taxes and raising spending. And Senator Obama has said, he's proposed $1 billion in new spending, or $100 billion in new spending out on the table. At the same time, he wants to cut taxes for 95% of Americans, which I guess that sounds great, but we can look at all the empires of the world from Rome all the way up through the present day, that we cannot continue on a trend when we're already running a rather large deficit and expect that we can change the economy without doing that.
Thank you. And now I'd like all of the four panelists to answer the same question. Does this feel like an important moment of historic change? And maybe also the follow-up I asked, if one important transformation comes out of this election, what would you want it to be? Emily, you want to start us off?
Sure. And I do think that this does feel like a pretty substantial election. Again, it's my first time voting in a presidential election, too, so perhaps that's part of it. But from a sort of a different perspective, I'd say one thing that's really struck me is, as we talked about, the mobilization of youth. And just to give an example of this, there's an organization or initiative by the Energy Action Movement, which is a national youth organization, devoted to promoting climate change solutions. It's called Power Vote. And